Dani, it's a pleasure to have you joining us. Fred will explain the situation, who you are, why you're famous, etc., etc., etc. But it's very important that we mention this right at the start, that it is Fred's birthday. And
yay
for Fred. So,
hip hip Fred, are we going to sing for Fred or rather not?
Yeah, I mean, just implicitly, we can just sort of like think.
Hum it.
Happy birthday, Fred.
No.
Anyway, Fred, I hope you're having a fantastic day and that you're now getting younger and younger as the time goes by.
This is the obvious highlight, of course.
I see. Okay.
With a sad day, then.
As a birthday gift, we are going to allow you to be grumpy, and we will meet all your grumpiness with nothing but good cheer and
my
and
song will win.
Yeah, no, well, no, I'm not sure if we will do that. You know, when it comes to winning, it's like when Chuck Klosterman said that in all the years he worked at Spin, nobody remembered who they put first. But the year they put Nevermind second for Album of the Year, everybody remembered that. You know, so we can't just let a mediocre song win just because it's your birthday.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, I'm going to introduce you, Dani. Is it okay if I read out from the Poetry International bio? Because I think that's quite a nice one.
That's many moons ago, but you're welcome.
That's many moons ago, but I'll fill in the last bit. Okay, here we go. Dani Marais was born in Kimberley in 1971. Went to school in Pretoria and studied at the University of Stellenbosch. He went on to study German mathematics and philosophy in Oldenburg, Germany. For quite some time, he lived in Germany, where he taught at an elementary school. He is the editor of PoesieNet, I don't think if you still do that, and regularly writes a column on rock and roll for the South African magazine Bielt. He writes book reviews for Rapport and translated the first comic strip of his ex-wife, Carlien de Villiers, entitled Meine Mutter war eine schöne Frau. My mother was a beautiful woman, in German. His poems were included in New Cemetery with Antje Kroeg and Alfred Schaffer, 100 Jahre Later, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of stuff he's done. His debut in Die Buitenste Ruimte appeared in 2006. And I believe, Dani, well, I have to add that you have been a very, very dear friend of mine for the last, I don't know how many years by now, 18 years or something?
Fred, I think it started about 2004 when we were both writing Sonia's page.
Yeah.
And we made a mixtape or a mix CD.
I got to know of you through a mixtape that Sonia Lutz, who was a mutual friend, I didn't know you then, gave to me. It wasn't a tape, it was a mixed CD tape, you know, like the way we related it. And I was really impressed, because I'm a bit skeptical usually, but I was really impressed with what was on that CD. And there were quite a few bands that I didn't know, quite a few that I didn't know, but I liked also the mix. There was Kids in America, or Nine and 90 Luftballone, one of those tunes was in it, but also things like Ben Folds 5 and The Handsome Family, who I didn't know yet. So I thought, sounds like an intriguing guy. And then we finally met and turned out we had another mutual friend, which was Mark Kannemeyer. And since then we've been in touch and we exchange things about music. So every now and then it takes a while for us to catch up, but we've been very good at keeping this friendship going. And I understand next month you have a new book out, right? A book of poetry.
Yes. Tell us about that.
Brief.
Well, it's called Ek en Jy Bestaan Nie, You and I Don't Exist. I realized that when you're middle age, you feel like you don't exist. And you realize you write for people who barely exist. But it's a lot about the grievances of class and race and living in Stellenbosch and all those things people tend to ignore. I mean, we live in a kind of a cold civil war, really, in this country. And also in Stellenbosch. And so many things people don't talk about because they just uncomfortable. So I tried to talk about that and I might not be thanked for that. So I'm between excitement and some raw panic, you know. So we'll see, but I feel it's like something I had to do and it took me 10 years. So whatever. Beyond here probably lies nothing, but we'll see.
Dani, most of your poetry is in Afrikaans. So what I did was that I went on to ChatGPT And I asked ChatGPT to write a poem in English in your style that honors Bruce Springsteen. I'll just read you one of the verses from this poem. We dance in the rain, we cry and laugh with your music that heals the soul's rough path. You are more than just a rock and roll hero. You're a symbol of a world that earns its glow. What do you think of that?
Well, this has done nothing to redeem ChatGPT in my eyes. Somebody's got to shut that shit down.
Can I just say that is nothing like Donnie's poetry? Absolutely nothing. I don't know where ChatGPT got the stuff from.
But does ChatGPT understand Afrikaans?
Yeah, of course.
It does have better. It's not bad. It's a lot better than Google Translate. But I suppose it didn't have that much material to work with, you know, so, well, did its best.
All right. Well, let's get into it for today. The challenge for today is to choose songs which are just a perfect story in themselves, but not necessarily a ballad, something that just encapsulates a great story. It could be a fantastic movie if somebody ever wanted to do that. I should say that I've sort of focused on music, which is sort of has a kind of poetic element in Donnie's honor. There's no winners, but somebody obviously gets the prize of the greatest song. And it's very difficult now because it's Fred's birthday. So I don't know how we're going to deal with that. But we'll double cross that bridge when we get to it, as we say. Anyway, Donnie, here is your first song.
Believed in their hearts, they were headed for stage lights and Lear jets and fortune and fame. So in script that made prominent use of a pentagram, they stenciled their drumheads and guitars with their names. And this was how Cyrus got sent to the school where they told him he'd never be famous. And this was why Jeff, in the letters he'd write to his friend, helped develop a plan to get even. When you punish a person for dreaming his dream, don't expect him to thank or forgive you. The best ever death metal band out of Denton will in time both outpace and outlive you. Hail Satan!
Donnie, tell us about the band and the song.
Well, so my cousin, I mean, we've had a musical exchange going since our teens. He introduced me to this band, and it's part of John Darnell, who's basically the Mountain Goats. It's his lo-fi era. It's all, there's the tape hisses there. And it's one of those times where it doesn't always work, but this is a song where the aesthetic perfectly suits the subject matter. Later, we went on to do much more orchestral things. He's also a novelist who's been, his first novel in 2014 was nominated for the National Book Award. So he's just a fantastic storyteller. But what I love about this one is, you know, it reminds me of a guy I knew in Germany called Jens Finger. And he had a nose ring and lots of piercings, and he played in a death metal band called Obscenity. And their second album was called Human Barbecue. And his favorite T-shirt was that scene in The Exorcist with the possessed girl who says, "Your mother sucks cocks in hell." That was like his favorite T-shirt. But he was the sweetest guy. You go to his apartment and he has these, like, he loved cute animals. So I had pictures up of cute animals. And when he did his civil service, he worked in some home for, I think it was, yeah, it was sort of mentally challenged kids, whatever, something like that. Really sweet social work stuff. But he had this dream, and I think this is a kind of song, it could be like a perfect indie flick. And it's interesting that John Darnell says he worked in a psychiatric hospital for a long time. And he says when you are an adolescent, it's the closest look you get at God's face. You're not rotten yet. And he wanted to write something about that, but also about people who then want to get even. They realize that these dreams of theirs are silly and they're not going to realize them. And then this song, which is like the story song, ends in this cathartic chorus of Hail Satan, which is everything, if anything, it's really melancholy. It's like a cry of desperation. Satan is not going to come for these guys. It always stayed with me. He played it for many, many years. And he says, well, these guys are still like friends to him in his mind. They were like a concoction of a lot of guys he knew. And some of them were adolescents who went to mental institutions. There's something incredibly sweet about the song. I don't know if you agree.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is incredible. It's incredible. He finds an enormous amount of sympathy for the members of the death metal band. Just makes the whole tale and captures their disappointment. So presumably they are in jail at this point, and all of their dreams are not going to come true. Anyway, it's very sad.
Well, one of them is in a psychiatric institution, but I also just love that first verse where he goes, the best ever death metal band out of Denton was a couple of guys who had been friends since grade school. One was named Cyrus, the other was Jeff, and they practiced twice a week in Jeff's bedroom. And then he says they never settled on a name, but the top three contenders after weeks of debate were Satan's Fingers and the Killers and the Hospital Bombers. Now, this came out before the Killers' debut, so the Killers would not have been a candidate past 2004. But there's something so real about these guys, you know, you really feel for them. And then, of course, your own life didn't turn out like you hoped at all. You're so at the point where you want to say, hail Satan tonight.
Have you guys ever seen that movie about that Norwegian death metal? No, they're black metal, I think. Mayhem. The ones whose members killed each other. The guitarist killed the singer, or the other way around. It sort of reminds me of that, in that these were three kids at high school, and they were into metal, and they heard some English metal band who had a song called Black Metal. And they named their genre of music after that. But they took it way too far. You know, they went into burnings. Remember all those burnings? I think it was in the 2000s, early 2000s, late 90s. And they created a whole subgenre with followers who also started burning churches. And it's an excellent documentary. I mean, it's a bit scary because he also ate something of the guy that he murdered. Like he picked a bit of skull and hung the skull on the chain and ate a bit of meat, allegedly. It's you know, it's like these three boys in your band, they take it too far. That's what happens. You become mayhem. I think he's released from jail. He's back making music now. And, you know, all these guys, they just continue. It's fascinating. And also there's another documentary about this band, Anvil. Have you ever seen that? I think they were Canadian or something. They go down and then they have a sort of revival, and that's a beautiful story. That's the redemption, and then you come out of it. This mayhem, there's no redemption, I must say.
Yeah. But I love the Anvil story, and I also love the thing that often there's a lot of kind of violence and darkness in pop and rock. But I think mostly it's actually just a place to vent and get rid of things.
Yeah.
And there's something very healthy about that. So, yeah, metalheads and goths, I know, they're often very sweet people. They're just sad and disillusioned. And this is a place to go.
And it's pure escapism often. Yeah. No, it's great. I like the song and I like the sentiments. It's a good start.
Okay, Fred, your first song.
Blackjack David come around through the woods, singing so loud and merry. His voice kept ringing through the green, green trees. He smiled at the haired maiden. He spied at the haired maiden. Would you forsake your husband, dear? Take your baby, would you forsake your fine, fine home and go with Blackjack David? Go with Blackjack David.
Okay, tell us about that, Fred.
This is a very old song. It's from 1956 and it's called Blackjack David. And was recorded in the Sun Studios in Memphis by a rockabilly singer called Warren Smith. Well, there's some pictures of him together with Al. He wasn't very famous. But the reason why I chose this song, can I blow my own trumpet?
Sure.
And read from my book, Blues for the White Man, which came out a couple of years ago. Anyway, I did research into country and rock and roll and all that. And I traveled to the Deep South. And I stumbled upon a book by Nick Toshis. I don't know how you pronounce his name. T-O-S-C-H-E-S, Toshis, I guess. And he wrote a book called Country, The Twisted Roots of Rock and Roll. And he takes us back, way back in time, to Irv Orpheus with his golden voice and lyre. I'm reading from the book now. Who loses his true love, Eurydice, after she's bitten by a snake. Deeply hurt, he decides to rescue her from the underworld. Moved by his music, Hades, the god of the dead, permits Eurydice to accompany Orpheus back to the land of the living. There's one condition. On their way up, the lyre player is not allowed to turn around to admire his beautiful love. Of course, he cannot resist temptation. Anyway, she's forced back to the netherworld. An inconsolable Orpheus then renounces everything to do with lust or love. But for this, he pays a price. The mad women of Greece cannot accept the fact that this handsome chap ignores them. They tear him apart and throw his head into the river where it keeps singing. So that's the ancient story, right? Now, the myth with its don't look back moral lives on in numerous versions in the Bible, Lot, in the Quran, Lut, and the old British folk and gypsy tunes with titles such as The Gypsy Lady, The Draggletail Gypsies, and Black Jack Davy. And famous singers such as Woody Guthrie and the Carter Family recorded their version of this fateful journey, the words transmuted into a tale of a married woman who exchanges a dull existence for an escape with a vagabond. The couple eventually pays the price for their adventure at the bottom of the river. So this guy, this Mr. Warren Smith, according to Toshis, makes the oldest rock song ever to have been recorded by a rock and roller, a song with a history that goes back several thousand years. And later, Bob Dylan, the White Stripes, and the Waterboys all made their version of this song. But this, you could say, the oldest rock and roll song ever. So beat that.
Okay. Wow.
But how, I mean, in terms of spirit or recording, because, I mean, surely, you know, there were recordings before these Sun recordings that we would call.
No, he's the first rock and roller who recorded Black Jack Davy.
Oh, okay.
So this is the first rock and roll version of that song before you had the Carter Family and a lot of old folk. But he was the first rockabilly dude who thought, I'm going to take this still and turn it into a rock and roll. It was a B-side of a single. It wasn't even the A-side.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
What an incredible story.
It is, yes.
But obviously we're not rockabilly fans because we're like, what is that?
But I thought, I chose it because of folk music. You know, folk music uses those old tales. Dylan does it as well.
That's right.
Yeah. And sort of transform it into modernity. And these songs live on and on and on and on and on forever. Because, of course, the morality is the same throughout history. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why this was interesting. And also because I thought I could do a folk version or the Carter Family. They do exactly the same version, actually, lyrically. But I thought it's fun to have the first rock and roll song that uses this. Mm-hmm. So that's why I chose it.
And I love that. I love old rockabilly. And I think I find it fascinating if you think of our Ari Spliss folk anthology and how old some of these songs are and how people like Nick Cave also revived some of it, like Henry Lee. And I mean, with Henry Lee, there's a lovely bit with a video where you can really see Nick Cave and PJ Harvey falling in love. It's undeniable, the awkwardness. You can see, okay, this is an affair coming. And then, of course, we get the boatman's call after that. Yeah,
it is. Yes.
At least they didn't physically kill one another.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so interesting, the connection between folk music and church music and the kind of structure of popular music is so linked to the structure of folk music, and we still live with it today. So many pop songs have this verse-chorus structure that just seems to have endured. It's just very penetrating and powerful.
Well, it was to tell a story, of course, way back. Yes. So how do you remember a story is making it rhyme and give it a nice melody, because that's how people would pick up on it and how you yourself remember it as well.
I just think what's interesting to me always about folk, I've loved story songs since a kid, but it's that you have these often Puritan times where people officially held very strong religious beliefs. But in the folk songs, you find all this real darkness, you know. Dylan said folk is the only real death you can hear.
Although here the moral is, of course, that's why the Carter Family sing it, I guess. It's don't stray off the path. Yeah. Stick to your wife or husband and don't do anything naughty because you'll pay the price.
Yeah, but people will stray and pay the price.
And there's a weird link, as we always discover when we're going through these songs, with my first choice, which is this one.
Maggot comes three-foot face full of black soot, talking as the heat puts plants in the bed, but phone stopped anyway. Maggie says a minute, say they must bust an early man. Orders from the DA, look out, kid, don't matter what you did. But walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that care out of fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash the clean clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know it's where the wind blows.
All right, so that's Dylan, of course, the Subterranean Homesick Blues. The link is that there is a very famous video that was made to go along with the song, which was included in the movie Don't Look Back. So how creepy is that?
You said in your column that this is like a rap song, and I totally agree with you. It's not only a proto-rap song like the first one, but that is also one of the first music videos. It's a totally groundbreaking song.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I think it's interesting because, you know, he was surrounded by poets at this point. Allen Ginsberg is actually in the very famous video of him dropping cards with some of the lyrics of the songs on it. Some of them deliberately misspelled and different from the actual lyrics of the song. It was all kind of a bit of a hoot. The Subterranean bit, of course, is a reference to the Jack Kerouac novella called The Subterraneans. And it was a very kind of different style of writing, very immediate. You write about the first thing that comes to mind, and then you sort of travel on this little journey, and you're not sure where it goes. Anyway, I'm not sure that this completely fulfills the mandate of this discussion, but anyway, it's a great song.
It might not qualify as a story, but it's an incredible song. And it's just one of the first songs that really made me fall for Dylan. And when I listened to it again now, I thought of an interview with Paul Simon about 10 years ago, where he said all these retrospectives of the 60s came in, and he always came second to Dylan, and he hates coming in second. And he actually talked to it about, discussed it with his therapist. And he says he came to the conclusion that the thing with Dylan is that he's, whatever he's telling you, is always, you're never sure what he really means. It's always saying two or three things. And this song, you hear it as well, you know, it sounds like it's a bit of a prophecy, but it also sounds like a total piss take. And you can't really decide which, where Paul Simon says he's always just embarrassingly sincere. Whatever he does, he's just sincere old Paul Simon. Bob Dylan's always mysterious, and there's always a double edge to him. And this song just kicks, you know, it really still does.
Yeah. I was amazed when I was reading about it that it was the first song that got into the charts of Dylan's. You know, it was 65, he's been going for a while at this point. This is off the third album, May the Fourth one, I don't know. Anyway, okay, let's move on. Donnie, this is your next choice.
From a town of Lincoln, Nebraska, with a sawed-off 410 on my leg, through the badlands of Wyoming, I killed it in my bed. I can't see that I'm sorry for the things that we've done, at least for little while, sir, me and her, we had us some fun.
All right, Donnie, this is a very cheerful song for Fred's birthday.
Yeah. No, look. When I think of story songs, I immediately think of Springsteen. And my old friend of mine, Desmond Painter, always says, look, if Bob Dylan's a poet, Springsteen's a great short story writer. And in fact, Richard Ford, the Pulitzer winner, says the same thing. And Nebraska is his first album where he, in 1982, ventures in this kind of crime noir genre. He told great stories before, but now they've gone really dark. And it's like, the whole album is like Raymond Carver with a rhythm guitar. And once in a while, I do creative writing workshops and whatever. And what I'd usually tell people is, look, a great scene in a story, you want to do three things at the same time. You want to show who the character is. You want to create atmosphere and give people the setting. And you want to drive the plot forward. And of course, you need to create tension. And if you think like State Trooper on this album, it starts with New Jersey Turnpike riding on a wet night beneath the refinery's glow where the great black rivers flow. License registration, I ain't got none, but I got a clear conscience about the things that I've done. Now, that does all of that. You are with this guy and you know that he's desperate and he's done something really bad and illegal. And a number of these songs are like that, but this one is based in reality, the Nebraska one. And Springsteen wrote it after he saw Terrence Malick's movie Badlands. And it's based on the Charles Starkweather case, where Starkweather was 19 and he took a 14-year-old girl, Carol Fugate, along with him, and they killed like 10 people. And none of it really great motives. Anyway, there's a long backstory, and Springsteen went and phoned the reporter and whatever. But I think what's amazing about, I'm just going to read you the lyric, right? And then I'll tell you what Springsteen says about the song, because it's very short. But what he does in those six couplets is amazing. So he says, I saw her standing on her front lawn, just twirling her baton. Me and her went for a ride, sir. And 10 innocent people died. Now, that scene on the front porch is in Terrence Malick's movie as well. And from the town of Lincoln, Nebraska, with a sawed-off 410 on my lap, through the bad lands of Wyoming, I killed everything in my path. I can't say that I'm sorry for the things that we'd done, at least for a little while, sir. Me and her, we had us some fun. The jury brought in a guilty verdict, and the judge, he sentenced me to death, midnight in a prison storeroom with leather straps across my chest. Sheriff, when the man pulls that switch, sir, and snaps my poor head back, you make sure my pretty baby is sitting right there on my lap. They declared me unfit to live, said into that great void my soul be hurled. They want to know why I did what I did. Sir, I guess there's just a meanness in this world. And what's so chilling about that is that Springsteen used to do these kind of Steinbeck songs where the downtrodden and the poor are actually common heroes. But here there's no redemption whatsoever. And when Springsteen talks about the song in a storyteller series, he says, the thing is with a great story song, you need the specific detail is important. But if you can't pull up something out of yourself, a personal connection, it falls flat. And he says the personal connection here is that we all know how it feels to be condemned. We all reach a point in life where we are declared unfit to live. And so he talks about this incredible alienation that he's always felt. And that's just a real surprising twist when he says that. And then you realize that you're into this great void, your soul will be hurled. And apparently he was reading a lot of Flannery O'Connor. So that last chilling line is actually, it's based on one of her stories. It's hard to find a good man. There's something of the misfit in there. But also that line where he says, I'm not sorry about the things we've done. He wrote that line, Starkweather, from prison to his dad. He wasn't sorry. Okay. Yes. So you have a case that's like in Cold Blood, you know, it's not a who done it, it's a why done it. And Springsteen does this why done it in like six verses. And in the end, the answer is devastating.
It's astounding. This album is just one of the most astounding albums of all time, I think. Partly because it's such in such a contrast to his own history and his own songwriting style. And somehow everything came together. The slightly echoey simplicity of the sound, it's just, you know, it like cuts you like a knife. I mean, it is really, it's just the most extraordinary, powerful statement. And I've always found it incredible that he never really did this kind of album again. There were some songs, I guess, you could subsequent to this that would fall into the category, but it must have been an incredibly dark period in his life. Yep. But anyway, remarkable for contrast, if nothing else.
Well, he wrote it after a breakdown where he had his first really terrible bout with depression, and his childhood actually caught up with him. But I think he did similar stuff in The Ghost of Tom Joad and Devils and Dust. which were also story songs. But I think it's the first one where he ventured into this kind of storytelling. And Steve Earle said with Born to Run, he found his voice. And with Darkness on the Edge of Town, he found Our Voice, which was his fourth album. But here he finds something else. It's spooky.
Wasn't it like an accidental album almost? Like he recorded these things in a hotel room, weren't meant to become an album. And then somebody said, no, these sound great and don't do anything with it. Like demos almost?
He recorded them in a farmhouse on a Tiak-like four-track, which was quite something at that stage. He could do a little bit of mixing. And then they tried to make a band album out of it. And in the end, they gave up. And then little Stevie Van Zandt told them, look, the demos are the songs. Yeah. These haunted strip demos with a little bit of pedal here or whatever, that's it. Anything else is going to ruin it. And that's the best advice little Stevie ever gave Springsteen, I think.
I never listened to the lyrics of this song. I must say, you know, how weird it is. I've heard an album a million times and I never gave any attention to the lyrics of this song. And I read them and I thought, Jesus, that's quite something.
And it's also, in terms of structure, there's no chorus. The two most haunting harmonica pieces in all of Springsteen is the one in the river and this one. The harmonica is the chilling chorus here.
Yeah, the harmonica works very well.
Great. Masterpiece.
Masterpiece. No question. So let's see if Fred's song can match that.
She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a background voice she said hello.
Fred, I have to say, this is a great story. I mean, this is also a movie and a song. It's just fantastic.
I wanted, you know, it was between the Beatles and the Kinks, because the Beatles have that She's Leaving a Home on Sgt. Pepper, which I think is such a heartbreaking story about these parents who don't understand. It's a real 60s kind of vibe as well. Parents don't understand the child after many years of living alone. You know, she's living with her parents. She's living alone. So it's a great line. And she leaves home. But also, it's not going to end well with this girl out on the streets with all the drugs and everything. Anyway, but then I thought that Lola's song was so way ahead of its time. You know, the boys will be girls and girls will be boys. It's a mixed up, muddled up, shook up world, except for Lola. And it's not, he doesn't make fun of this Lola character who could be either transgender or a crossdresser, or we don't really know. Certainly is a man, because that's what he sings at some stage. And I thought it was done with empathy, and we're 54 years later. And I checked on Reddit where they discussed these things, and trans people were trying to find fault with the song, and there was, I'm glad I'm a man, that they took offense to, because somewhere he sings, I'm a man, I'm glad I'm a man or something. But that was all they could find. And I thought, that's a sign of great timeless songwriting by Ray Davies. Mm. And it's a great song to match. You know, it's got a great chorus, got a great guitar riff. They had to change Coca-Cola to Cherry Cola because the BBC took offense. You can't do an ad for a product in a song. So they had to fly back from, I think, from New York to London to change one word, basically. So I thought, and it's a story. And there's all sorts of different stories of how he wrote the song and what it was about, which I don't think is as interesting as the song itself.
I just wanted to say about the Coca-Cola bit, I was wondering whether Coca-Cola also didn't want to be in that song, because I read somewhere that Lola is one of the reasons why the Kinks never broke through in America. There was something, you know, too perverse about them for the Americans.
No, they had a big argument with customs people, and then sort of like near fight or proper fight, and then they weren't allowed back in America for 5 years or something, just when all the other bands were breaking through. They had to sit back in England and wait. And then finally, I think in the sort of mid-70s, they were allowed again, and they started making sort of stadium rock, which wasn't their best period. I don't think it had anything to do with this song, but I might be mistaken.
I'm quite sure I read somewhere that there was a lot of resistance to this song.
No, I'm sure.
You know,
I don't think it was a hit in America even. It was a hit in England. It got number 2. No, I think it got number 8 or something in America.
Does it predate A Walk on the Wild Side?
It was around the same time. It's just a bit earlier, but there were a couple of songs that were dealing with this same kind of thing. And yeah, Walk on the Wild Side. And there's Candy Darling. Apparently, some say that Ray Davies wrote it about meeting Candy Darling, who was mentioned
in the Lou Reed song as well.
Yeah, she was part of that whole Warhol scene.
You know what I like about the song? It progresses. There's a kind of narrative thread to it, because this young guy goes into a club and then he just falls in love with this, we presume, transgender person. And by the end of the song, he's completely smitten and is completely resolved with it. I also think it demonstrates a little bit how music sometimes predates and anticipates quite big social changes. And this was a good example.
But it was only 3 years after homosexuality was unbanned in the UK. I mean, up to 67, it was illegal to be gay or to practice gayness. And then, but also he later said a few things about it, Ray Davies. He said it doesn't really matter what sex Lola is. I think she's all right. And I think that sort of sums it up. Bowie, of course, had Rebel around the same time as well. You don't know whether you're boy or girl, your hair's all right. So it was the time of sexual revolution, for sure. But he did it in a subtle way without condemning or approving. He just, as Tim said, you know, this guy, I've had those encounters where you meet somebody who's, you think it's a girl, utterly beautiful, and then she opens her mouth and a totally different voice from what you expect comes out. A bit sort of like, okay. And there was that movie. What was the movie again?
Oh, the Crying Game.
The Crying Game, which was also
Chuck Klosterman in his new book says in the 90s, some movies couldn't be made before the 90s and they can't be made again. And he says The Crying Game is probably a movie they wouldn't green light now. It wouldn't be made again. But have you seen Baby Reindeer on Netflix that everybody's talking about? Yeah, I really like that. And I must say, I have a crush on that, on the trans actress in that series.
The Mexican,
Yeah, I even went to follow her on Instagram.
Well, here they use the transgender actor, that's actress or actor, whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is good, because in The Crying Game, of course, they didn't.
Exactly. But yeah, I think it's a lovely song. And as I said, in the heart of it, it's really accepting, you know.
Yeah, no, it is,
All right, let's move on. This is on a different tack.
I wish that he was here tonight. It's so hard to obey his sad request of me to kindly stay away. So this is how I tell Amelia it was just a false alarm. A ghost of aviation, she was swallowed by the sky or by the sea. Like Icarus ascending on beautiful, foolish arms. Amelia, it was just a false alarm.
All All right, so that's Joni Mitchell, and the song is Amelia, obviously a reference to Amelia Earhart, the airplane pilot from the early days who tried to make it across the Atlantic Ocean and died on the way. It's a quite a curious song. She sort of overlays the history of Amelia Earhart with her own and tries to tell a story about being lost and being in a sort of cold and place with these sort of strange and odd references to the Amelia Earhart story. And it's just very absorbing, very beautiful song, I think, just precisely because it's not a tangible story in any direct way. And then it has this strange chorus line, which also leaves you hanging a little bit. I just think technically with Joni Mitchell, you do expect these strange streetwise travelogues. And this is a particularly good one.
I think it's one of her top five songs. And it's interesting when this comeback she made with who's the woman who can be quite annoying, Brandi Carlile, who kind of mothers her around. But anyway, when she made this comeback, Brandi asked her, so what's your favorite record? And then she said, well, for a long while, it was Ajira, because she loved the writing on that record. And this is Ajira. And it's also Jaco Pastorius, the great fretless bass player, who colors in the song. And then it's just this beautiful extended metaphor of the hexagon of the heavens and the six strings of my guitar. And that haunting chorus, Amelia, it was just a false alarm. I think it's so, so beautifully done. And apparently the story she said was that she drove across country with a few guys, but she had the secondhand Mercedes she bought that kept stalling, and she didn't have a driver's license. So she would tailgate behind truckers. So she crossed the desert in the way that Amelia crossed the Atlantic. And I think that's where where that parallel came in.
Donnie, do you understand what the false alarm was? And why was it just a false alarm?
I pondered that quite a lot, because we did at the Wordfest last year, we did a Joni Mitchell tribute, me and Cornelis Breitenbach and a few people. And Skal Kubert joined us, and he's a huge fan of Jaco Pastorius. And I don't think any of us came to a conclusion, but I think in many ways, I see it as, you know, these big things that you feel that you're supposed to look for in life. Maybe they were just false alarms. And in this case, it's about her not finding love, really, and spending her life in icy altitudes like Amelia. I don't know, but somehow it really resonates without me knowing exactly what she means there.
Yes, exactly. You can sort of imagine Amelia Earhart. She's traveling across the Atlantic and there's some problem with a plane and she thinks it's just a false alarm, but actually it wasn't. I don't know. That's another possible interpretation.
It's another song without a chorus. I mean, that one line you can't really see as a chorus. And whereas Lola definitely has a chorus, but all the other songs so far didn't have a chorus.
Yeah.
Death Metal band
also no chorus.
Bob Dylan didn't. The Rockabilly one didn't really have a chorus. So that's interesting. Those narrative songs don't have a chorus.
You know what the Death Metal band one reminds me of? It's one of your favorite bands as well, Fred, is Wilco, the Misunderstood song, where it builds up to that point where it goes, I'd like to thank you all for nothing at all. And I saw that in concert where it's like, people go into a frenzy and he just keeps repeating that. And it's the same as the Hail Satan effect. It's like this release for all this, I don't know, unresolved tension. And it just
That's good. I like the song. It's a beautiful song.
All righty. Donnie's last.
Then one night, there's a scream in the night, and you say, who's that kicking up a row? And you see me kind of staring out the window. And you say, what's she got to stare at now? I'll tell you. There's a ship, the Black Freighter, turns around in the harbor, shooting guns from her bow. Now, you gentlemen can wipe off that smile off your face. Every building in town is a flat one. This whole frickin' place will be down to the ground. Only this cheap hotel standing up safe and sound. And you yell, why do they spare that
that's what you say? Why do they spare that one? All the night through, through the noise and to-do, you wonder who is that person that lives up there. And you see me stepping out in the morning, looking nice with a ribbon in my hair. And the ship, the black freighter, runs a flag up its masthead and a cheer rings the air.
So, as far as I'm concerned, this is one of the greatest songs of the 20th century or the last 100 years. It premiered in 1928, part of the three penny opera, the Drei Groschen. Brechtenweil, the original singer was Lotte Lenya, and I love that version as well. And she was an interesting, she was Weil's first wife. She also played a Bond villain in the Rush, in From Russia with Love later in America. But of course, this it's like this song was made for Nina Simone. It made an incredible impression on a lot of people, but I'm just going to share you the little bit in Chronicles where Bob Dylan talks about how 64 or something, he went down. No, it must have been earlier, but he went down to a theater and he saw a review, and this is his reaction. He says, within a few minutes, I felt like I hadn't slept or tasted food for about 30 hours. I was so into it. The song that made the strongest impression was a show-stopping ballad, A Ship, The Black Freighter. Its real title was Pirate Jenny. But I didn't hear that in the song, so I didn't know what the real title was. It was sung by some vaguely masculine woman dressed up like a scrubbing lady who performs petty tasks, goes about making up beds in a ratty waterfront hotel. What drew me into the song at first was the line about the ship, the Black Freighter, that comes after every verse. That particular line took me back to the foghorns of ships that I'd heard in my youth, and the grandiosity of the sounds that stuck in my mind seemed like they were right on top of us. And then he says, this is a wild song, big medicine in the lyrics, heavy action spread out. Each phrase comes at you from a 10-foot drop, scuffles across the road, and then another one comes like a punch on the chin. And then there's always that ghost chorus about the black ship that steps in, fences it all off, and locks it up tighter than a drum. It's a nasty song, sung by an evil fiend, and when she's done singing, there's not a word to say. It leaves you breathless. In the small theater, when the performance reached its climactic end, the entire audience was stunned, sat back, and clutched their collective solar plexus. I knew why I did, too. The audience was the gentleman in the song. It was their beds that she was making up. It was their post office that she was sorting mail in, and it was their school she was teaching in. This piece left you flat on your back, and it demanded to be taken seriously. It lingered. Woody had never written a song like that. And that's the interesting thing, is that he says in Chronicles, the mix for him was Rimbo saying, I am someone else. So he changed his name. I was not me. He loved Woody, but Woody was traditional folk and protest singing. But he mixed it up with Brecht. And then he later goes on and to say that in a few years' time, I'd write and sing songs like It's All Right, Mom, Only Bleeding, Mr. Tambourine Man, Lonesome Death of It, Hattie Carroll, Who Killed Davy Moore, Only a Pawn in Their Game, A Hard Rain's Are Gonna Fall. And he said, if I hadn't gone to the Theatre de Lille and heard the ballad Pirate Jenny, it might not have dawned on me to write them or that songs like that could be written. And then, of course, the song runs through, if you think of Tom Waits reinventing himself in the 80s, that's basically Brechtenweil. It's Tom Waits going back to the Three Penny Opera. And yes, the song is, I think for me also, just in a South African context, when I lived in Germany, the thing I did my exam on was the Weimar time and that literature of the time. And it connected to me because I felt that South Africa in the 90s was that kind of place. Mm. It's like between wars, everything's up in the air. A lot of progressive stuff is happening, but there's drama, there's hunger, there's inequality. It's a mess. And then this song is about inequality and getting even. And you think of this, so many people working in such dire circumstances in South Africa. And every once in a while you think, how many of them are feeling like Pirate Jenny?
Yeah.
It must be millions. I'd be Pirate
so
Jenny.
It was traditionally in German, I guess, right?
It was in German, Die Seeräuber Jenny.
Who translated it? Do you know? Or is it? You speak German. Is it a good translation?
This one is, there's a translation I like better. I like Nina Simone's version best, but Marianne Faithfull sings a translation by Frank McGinnis later. And the reason I like the Frank McGinnis translation better is because in the German, when they ask, they bring all the men to her and they ask, who shall we kill? And then Lotte Lenya just coolly says, all of them. And when the soft heads roll, I say, hoppla. And in the German, that hoppla works so well. And in Marianne Faithfull version, you have that, but not in Nina Simone's version. But of course, Nina can take a really trite song and turn it into something haunting. So she does the older translation, the Black Freighter. In the German, it's the ship with 8 sails and 50 cannons. So it's a bit of a different thing. But I mean, Nina brings it all across.
What does she say instead of hoppla?
She doesn't say hoppla. She says, they asked me, kill them now or later. Noon by the clock or so still by the dock. In that quiet of death, I'll say, right now. Then they'll pile up the bodies and I'll say, that'll learn ya. But that's not the perfect translation. But yeah, I think it's hard to overestimate this song in any way.
No, it's incredibly dramatic. I remember reading that same passage in Dylan's book. And in some ways, I'm quite surprised. One of the problems with Dylan is that you just can't trust him because he says things that, you know, just come to his mind.
Unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
Partly because the songs that he refers to, that he talks about, you know, are they in the same tradition as Pirate Jenny? Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. Is there maybe also from the perspective of the oppressed? I get that. But you can see the link, I guess, is that he wanted songs that were in a narrative style and had drama. I suppose that was the overlap.
Yeah. I think the other link, Dylan is a total master of self-mystification, and he talks about his guitar playing in that book where you think, okay, well, this is total mumbo jumbo. It makes no sense whatsoever. But I think what he took from this is that this one has a chorus. It has a haunting chorus, but the storytelling is in a very different mood, and it's just basically a rhythmic kind of piano chords that you hear.
Yes.
And it's got a kind of a long form that I think Dylan then really started using very effectively. And there's something about the darkness of a hard rain's gonna fall that I also hear. So definitely, I think it opened up the possibility for him for telling like really long stories.
Yeah,
actually.
I think it's the different way of songwriting that he learned from that.
Guthrie is very, very close to the folk mold, you know.
Yeah.
This was more theatrical.
I only knew The Doors, who did Show Me the Way to the Next Whiskey Bar. That was my first introduction to Kurt Weill.
Mine too. I was very surprised to hear that it's not Jim Morrison. It's such a drinking
Jim Morrison song.
Morrison should have written it. But I really think they are, Brecht and Weill was scarily good. It's also interesting because they were really, you know, staunch socialists, but they captured something about the human condition, which was beyond and transcended ideology. It was something darker. It was actually, you feel like, well, socialism can't work if you look at man the way Brecht and Weill looks at mankind, you know.
But I mean, it's so powerful as well with Nina Simone. She brings her whole history to the song. You know, stylistic genius. It's just, she obviously loved this song. You know, you can sort of tell with the sort of tenderness with which she sings it. It was really completely in her mode. And it says a lot about her in some ways.
Yeah, I think she's just awe-inspiring as an interpreter. I'm talking about where you hear a song first, you know, that Nick Cave on the Bad Seeds, the Live Seeds album, there's Plain Gold Ring. And yeah. I love that Nick Cave version. And then I went to listen to Nina's version from 1959, and I thought, like, Nick, you can't hold a candle to Nina. Well, how did you even attempt this, man? I mean, this is such a pale, it pales in comparison. But anyway, yeah.
All right. Well, time is pressing, so we're in a bit of a jam, I guess.
Fumble for change. Pull out the queen. Smiling, beguiling. I put in the money. And pull out a plum behind me. Whispers in the shadows, rock blazing voices, hating, waiting. Hey boy, they shout, have you got any money? And I say, I'm gonna take money and I take away curry. I'm on the way home to my wife. She's been lining up the country and now she's expecting me. Polishing her glasses and pulling out the cork. I'm down in a tube station at midnight.
That was the proper jam.
That was a real jam. The real jam.
They're down at the tube station at midnight. Yeah, I chose this song for various reasons. A, because, you know, when you were in England in the 70s, there was something very scary in London, and the chance of getting beaten up by skinheads or whoever wanted to beat you up was quite big. And then I heard the Jam song, I think it's from 1978 or somewhere, it's from their third album, All What Comes. And you so identify that man who's there after hard day's work, took a takeaway curry on his way home to his wife. And then there's these guys and they smell of pubs and right-wing clubs and Wormwood Scrubs as well, which is the jail. And I mean, he gets beaten up very, very badly. And I think, well, they leave it a bit open, but I think he doesn't survive this whole accident. And I thought, you know, I like you guys, songs that refer to places and they name places. And here, of course, it's the tube station in London. And a lot of, as Dani says, you know, the little details, like when he starts, the distant echo of faraway voices boarding faraway trains to take them home to the ones that they love and who love them forever. And then he goes about cold and uninviting, partially naked, except for toffee wrappers and this morning's papers. Mr. Jones got run down. It's like the headline from the paper.
Yeah.
Headlines of death and sorrow that tell of tomorrow. Madman on the rampage. And I thought old Paul Weller turned out to be much more than a punk. He's a poet. Mm. And the poetry shines through in this song. And it's not a punk song even. It's got that sort of tension. And you know something bad's going to happen. But he holds it back. And then towards the chorus, it explodes. I'm down in two station at midnight. Whoa, whoa, whoa. And I think it's a great song. I think it's one of the best songs he's ever written.
Yeah, it's melodic, and I also really like the end where, once again, as you say, those specifics, the last things that he see, that makes it very real. And so it's gritty and catchy at the same time.
The wine will be flat and the curry's gone cold.
Yeah, and the sign that, what he says, Jesus saves, sprayed by some atheist.
Yeah, and the British Rail poster read, have a away day, a cheap holiday, do it today. It's perfect mixing details with the message without putting it on too much. You know, it's not like on the nose, but you can feel the fear of this poor guy there in those awful London undergrounds in the 70s.
What I remember of the tube in London is also this idea of, like, people, you know, crammed into a tight space, and there's something very claustrophobic about it. But then you have all these ads, and these ads are all these are promised these wonderful
ads,
things,
you
know, selling you these, you know, things.
Yes.
It's like a big contrast.
Beautiful
which
women.
Which captures there.
Exactly. And you stand there, wait for 10 minutes for this thing to, and keep looking at this beautiful woman in this it smells of piss often, and you know, there's bits of puke on the. Oh, it can be so awful.
And then you get into this train and you're crammed, like your neck is crammed into like this, you know. Yeah.
And certainly after closing time in the pubs, then you get that crowd as well.
Oh. Yeah.
I was never a crazy sort of fan of the Jams. Fred, you've sort of opened my eyes a bit. I think it is an incredible song, and it's actually a precursor to a lot of Paul Weller's sort of his career post the Jam, in which he's written some really classic, you know, really wonderful songs. So thanks for that. All right, last song. Here we go.
Well, if no one ever marries me, I shan't mind very much. Buy a squirrel in a cage and a little rabbit hutch. No one marries me. No one marries me. No one marries me. No one marries me. Well, if no one marries me. Cottage near a wood and a pony all my own. Little lamb quite clean and tame that I can take to town. When I'm really getting old at 28 or 9, buy myself a little orphan girl and bring her up as mine. No one marries me. No one marries.
This is Natalie Merchant, and this song is If No One Marries Me. I just thought this whole album, to me, was so interesting for a lot of different reasons. So Natalie Merchant, she was well-known-ish, I think, from the Thousand Maniacs. But she took a break and spent 5 years putting an album together in which she put music to established poems. And she did an absolutely enormous amount of work on it. Eventually ended up with this album called Leave Your Sleep. And the album completely bombed. you can see on Spotify how many people have listened to songs. And there's almost no song on this album other than this one that really got any kind of significant airplay. I often wonder why that is. I mean, this particular song was not written by a well-known poet. Poet's name was Lisa Learman. She did not, in fact, get married, it turns out. And it's very short, but it's just so poignant. The first verse goes, if no one ever marries me, and I don't see why they should, nurse says I'm not very pretty and I'm seldom very good. It's very crisp and sad. And, but you know what it taught me in one way? That is that there is a difference between songwriting and poetry. Poetry is very difficult to turn into songs. There are different skill sets, I think. If somebody as brilliant as Natalie Merchant, who spent such a long time doing it and couldn't sort of quite pull it off, it's instructive, I suppose. Anyway.
Well, there's a great episode there, is setting poetry to music. And I totally agree with you. It's very hard. So there's actually a few examples where I think it worked incredibly well, but it's very difficult to pull off because it often works. They're different framing devices, I think, usually songs and poems, especially if it's free verse. It's very different. But Natalie Merchant, one of the most beautiful voices in the world.
Yeah,
she does.
I don't know whether poetry has moved on. Donnie, you'll know much more. But the narrative structure of poetry, seems to have gone out of fashion, where it seems to have stuck with songwriting. I don't know whether that's generally true or not, but I think it might be.
Well, there were definitely phases where the narrative poem was like rejected as something, it's like old hat or whatever. I, of course, love writing narrative poems, like I love narrative songs. And I think you have this kind of anecdotal verse that some people pull off incredibly well, like Tony Hoagland and Raymond Carver. But there's certainly different schools around that. But I think, to my mind, it's always like, People have this hyperbole, this idea of poetry with a capital P, which I think is nonsense. I read a book a while ago called Don't Read Poetry, Read Poems. It's like, you don't listen to music, you listen to Beethoven or by Beyonce. So pick a lane, pick something that you really like. And I think as songs, I think the great lyricists are incredibly scarce. They are more scarce than great novelists and great poets, because there are different constraints that you have to work in. And it doesn't, the whole song doesn't have to be poetry, but if you can frame three immortal lines that somebody is going to carry with them forever, I mean, that's poetry. Yes, yeah. You know,
it's very compressed. It has that overlap. Both of them are very disciplined arts. You have to be very specific and careful.
You've got very narrow confines, yeah.
Yeah. And when it does work, it's just such a joy. I don't think the Dylan song was like perfect for this little podcast, but it is incredible how the phrase, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, has just stuck, you know, for you and been repeated hundreds of different circumstances. It's incredible.
Yeah, I do like that about Dylan. And Marky Smith of the Fall also has it. Their songs don't really make sense, but they're phrases that you always remember and you think, that is so classic, that is so good. And it doesn't matter how it fits in the rest of the song, but they're just brilliant little phrases. There's also the parking meter reference in that Dylan song, which I always find great.
And I just loved, as a 16-year-old, I mean, I heard it for the first time, 16, 17-year-old, that line about, look out, kid, you're going to get hit. You know, you just felt like it's a personal warning, you know, that you had to take seriously.
And Johnny's in the basement mixing up the medicine. I mean,
yeah.
Yes. All right, people. Now we have to make this terrible choice here. And it's just incredibly difficult. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Let's each pick our own favorite one.
Okay.
How's that? Minus the gem. Okay, I've done it.
I just think Pirate Jenny is invincible, you know, just in terms of influence and reach and whatever. And I mean, it's almost 100 years old. Come on, guys. I mean, who's in the ring? Who sounds that vital after 96 years?
You'd be happy to hear. I was just about to say Pirate Jenny has to take the cake here. It just touches so many different nerves. And it has such a history.
But out of your top three, what's your favorite?
Oh, God. I don't know. Wow. I mean, it depends on whether we are confining ourselves to the mandate of this particular podcast. And in that case, I would have to go with Joni Mitchell, I suppose. But one of the advantages of having three of us is that we have a kind of deciding vote. So I'm afraid, Fred, on your birthday, you get humiliated by us choosing our guests.
I can't even say anything,
and,
can I?
Yeah, you can't. And I don't feel that sorry for you, because I've been in this position so many times now.
Also, Fred has teased me so much in the past 18 years about System of Adani and the Shins and whatever. He deserves to be teased a bit as well. But I would actually, if it was anything else, I'd be willing to say, oh, no, you know, let's give it to Fred. But like with this Pirate Jenny thing, it's just...
No, I think also the fact that Nina Simone sings it, which gives it a whole extra... you can't beat it. Sorry.
Okay, I'll give Fred here's the consolation prize. I would say Lola would be my second choice in this selection, just because it's such a groundbreaking story. I don't know whether
it's a stone cold classic. I loved it from the first time I heard it. It's one of those songs you hear it one time, you want to hear it again.
Yeah. Okay. But. Poor Dere and poor Paul, they won't win.
Right.
Nor will Joni.
Not Joni. Not even Bruce. Bob. Not even Bob.
This is a lovely little mixtape, right? I mean, songs. Good. I love all nine. Mm.
All right. The only thing that remains for us to do is to really say, Dani, it's just been a complete thrill to have you on our little pod.
Yes, it was
lovely.
Thank
you so much for... coming
Dani never disappoints.
Never disappoints.
Thank you so much for inviting me, guys. I love this. I mean,
you could go on for hours.
Yeah, and you know, I realized what I love about doing music shows, I realized with the Unhappy Hour, is this feeling of sharing great wealth. You know,
yeah.
It's like these songs, like they've meant so much personally. Now you can talk about them. And if one person discovers the song, I mean, you know, it's all been worthwhile.
No, very true.
Totally. All right, Fred, what are we doing next week?
It's your choice, unless we have a guest.
I think we've got a guest next week, don't we?
No.
All right, well, next week is a surprise. We'll announce it when it happens. Good. Okay, let's finish up playing the song of the day.
Noon by the clock, and so still at the dock, you can hear far gone miles away, and in that quiet of death, I'll say. Bodies, and I say that'll learn ya. And the ship, the Black Freight. Peers out to sea, and on it is me.